So earlier today, the wife, son, and I attended the LA Times Festival of Books on the campus of USC. It's a can't-miss event for us, overflowing with writers, with readers, with lovers of print and expression. And at one point, we ducked into a session where one of the speakers was Rabbi Sharon Brouse, author of The Amen Effect. And during the Q&A period, I asked the rabbi how she was able to stay disciplined when it came time to actually write. And I didn't really know what to expect from her answer. But her words stuck with me. "Here's what a friend told me," the rabbi said. "Get a shoelace, tie it around your ankle, then sit down and tie the other side of the shoelace to a chair. For 90 minutes, you have to sit there and write. Then, when it's done, you can untie it." I've got to say, that's pretty brilliant. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sing and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writer with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Tommy Tomlinson, the terrific writer and podcast host and the author of a fabulous new book, Dogland, Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show, which I have to say is probably my favorite read of the year. This is episode number 360. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks and you smell like Jack Sigma's armpit.
All right, Tommy, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And I have to say, we're recording this. Your book comes out April 23rd. We're recording this a bit early. And both of us probably woke up this morning to the news that O.J. Simpson died.
Yes. And the first thing I asked you when we got on here is, when's your book coming out? So it feels like that's something you should pull together right quick.
The O.J. Simpson quick read. So here's a question for you, from one guy who's written a bunch of books to another guy who's written a bunch of books. Is O.J. Simpson a book?
Yes. I mean, I think, well, there's two types. There's the, like, get something out real quick, capitalize on his death, you know, put together a bunch of notes, you know, basically like a clip job kind of book that could get out there and probably sell some copies. A book that's sort of like the big O.J. documentary, you know, the one that got so many awards and got so much praise a couple of years ago. I mean, that book would take a few years to put together, but I think it would be pretty amazing if you could. And it would be something that people would read forever, probably. And so, I think there's a book there, sure.
The thing I struggle with mentally that I'm not sure I'm a good enough writer to work with is, all right, you're writing about O.J. with the Bills. And then in the so-and-so season, he ran for so-and-so. In that game against the Jets, he cut back against blah, 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 and ran. And the whole while, you know you're writing about a guy who murdered people. So it's like, that's a tough, like, how do you make that a thing without that being this thing hanging over it? Or do you? Do you know what I mean?
See, I think that whole sports thing is like one chapter. You know, it's really condensed. Even though he obviously had this incredible sports life, and that's how he became famous the first time. But that's such a small part in the end of what made him interesting. You take those notes and those great runs at USC and at Buffalo, and you put it into like 2,000 words, and you move on.
So the Joe Ferguson quote, you know, he was the greatest running back I've ever seen. The Jews could do amazing stuff. Maybe not that important in the O.J. Simpson biography.
Yeah, any Joe Ferguson quote is not going to make the cut, I don't think.
Fair. All right, so it's really interesting. I'm a huge fan of your writing, huge fan of your career. And I think all the time, as we just discussed, about book topic choices. It kind of haunts me. Every 2 years at least, it certainly haunts me. And what's the right book to write? And will it resonate? And will it sell? And I don't know if I would have had the guts, and maybe guts is a wrong word, to write a book about the Westminster Dog Show. And it's a great book. And I'm not just a great book. I loved every page. I thought it was awesome. But I wonder, like, when you're pitching this idea to your agent or whoever, are they like, why the hell do we want a book about the Westminster Dog Show?
Well, actually, this came at the end of a long process. So after my first book came out, my memoir, The Elephant in the Room, you know, we were scouting around for the second book. And I pitched several ideas that the editor was just sort of lukewarm about. And this went on for, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks. And at some point he said, why don't you just send me every idea you've got? And I'm like, dude, I've got like hundreds of ideas. I'm not sending you every idea I got, but let me give you like the top 20. And so I went in, I keep a file, you know, with book ideas, story ideas. I called what I thought were the 20 best ones and sent them to him. Number 19 on that list, the whole thing said something like, nobody's ever done a great book about the Westminster Dog Show and somebody should. And he emailed me back. He said, that's the one. And so, you know, the first book I did, I wrote a whole proposal. It took months to do. It was like 40 or 50 pages. We just agonized over it. This book sold on one line, basically.
Wow.
But how that line came to be was years ago, years before all that, I was just watching the dog show one night, as most people do, and not really thinking of it. It's one of those things that's like on the screen as you're like folding laundry or whatever for me. But something popped into my head. I had this thought, like, are those dogs happy? Because they live such a different life than what we think of regular dogs living. And that is sort of an interesting question for me. And then it made me think about, well, are regular dogs, are they happy too? And so that sort of lifted it above, for me, just like go write about the Westminster Dog Show, to maybe something that might be more interesting and universal. And that's how it made that list in the first place.
Wait, so you have this list, you show it to your agent goes through it, looks over it, Westminster Dog Show jumps off the list. You don't have to write a proposal, which for people listening, proposals suck. It's my least favorite part of this whole process. 20-page proposal, I hate it. You don't have to write a proposal. He calls a bunch of different places and you get a book deal.
Well, actually, this was my editor who looked at this.
Oh, editor.
So okay. So the guy who edited my last book, they said, let's do another book together and let's talk about ideas. And my agent, you know, gave his blessing to that. And so we chewed over a bunch of ideas and that's how that one came up.
Most of the people I assume who listen to this podcast are writers and people who are kind of writing geeks. You get this deal to write about a subject you know almost nothing about. That literally was just number 19 on your list.
Yes. Right?
At least me going into a Tupac book, I do know a lot about Tupac, you know, or, you know, whatever. What do you do? What's your jumping off point?
Well, I think I signed the contract for this book toward the end of 2019. The next Westminster Dog Show was that February. And so I kind of plunged in right away, did a good bit of reading and stuff beforehand, read whatever else. There were some books that talked about the dog show world, and I read those and as many articles as I could, you know, get done before I could get there. But basically, I plunged in just by going to the show. And that was the one in 2020 at Madison Square Garden, which turned out to be the last one they had there, because about 2 weeks after it was over is when COVID hit. And COVID closed down dog shows like it closed down other, you know, sports entertainment events all over the country. And looking back, that turned out to be kind of a blessing for me, because instead of just like kind of blindly following this kind of traveling roadshow of what I came to call Dogland all over the country, I had a few months to just sort of get my bearings. So I'd been to this one dog show, kind of got a feel for what it was like. And then I was able to ask better questions of myself and of other people. So I had a few months where I just did a ton of reading, talked to a ton of people and stuff. And then when it started opening back up, like late that summer and the fall, I was able to go back in and be much smarter about what I was doing. But you're right, in the general sense, I started from zero. Like, I had no idea beyond just like watching on TV how a dog show worked, how dogs get chosen for dog shows, what the whole relationship is between the owners and the handlers and all these people, all the sort of entourage that comes with a show dog. I knew zero about that.
This is actually a subject I don't think I've ever delved into, and you just brought it up. And it's kind of interesting, which is, you know, people always say, like, your parents always say, well, there is no stupid question. Like, you'll be like, I have a dumb question. I'll say, no, there is no such thing as a stupid question. But if I were to go into talking to someone who works in hip hop, as an example, in relation to Tupac, and I were to say, well, what's a beat? They'd be like, that's a stupid question. Like, come on, what do you mean? Working on a Tupac book and you don't know what a beat is? You have no business. And I wonder for you, going into this, is there a base level of knowledge that you felt like you needed to accumulate so you didn't walk into the dog world sounding like a complete moron? Or is it okay to ask completely moronic questions to people who are experts?
I think more the second one. And my friend Joe Posnanski, who you know, brilliant writer, he used to tell this story, and maybe still does, about when he was first covering Major League Baseball, covering, I think, Cincinnati Reds. He went into the dugout one time and asked one of their pitchers, like, could you just tell me the difference between a curveball and a slider? And like all the other beat reporters just sort of like looked at him like, you idiot. But the truth is, they didn't really know either. Right. Like how it's gripped, what the arm motion's like. And this pitcher sat down and talked to Joe for like 20 minutes about how they're different and what you do as a pitcher to make them different. And at the end of it, like the other beat reporters were kind of like listening in, right? Because they weren't sure either. So I think there is, amongst some people who are inside, I think there's a willingness amongst some of those people to translate for people from the outside, you know? And I know when I first went to Westminster, I went to a couple of people. I said, look, I just don't understand what's going on here because they're shuttling dogs in and out so fast. I had no idea what was happening. I said, could you just explain to me? I'm just starting with all this. And a couple of people were like super helpful. Now, certainly there are also people who kind of look down their nose at somebody asking a question like that, but you know, screw them, go on to the next person. And I've never minded asking the basic stuff because I think thinking I know the basic stuff, when it's explained to me, I find out that there's a lot of basic stuff I really didn't know.
Do you view yourself now as an expert in the dog world?
Oh, hell no. No. I mean, I know more than like the average person watching it on TV, but I certainly don't know nearly as much as somebody who's been in that show ring for 20 or 30 years. What I am able to do, I think, and this is just a journalist's job, is to go into a situation, an unfamiliar situation, kind of get the gist of it and translate it to the outside world. You know, I more and more I do this, the more and more I think of my job as sort of a translator. You know, I'm in the dog show world. They're telling me it has its own language, its own rules, its own, you know, the way people dress, all this sort of thing that from the outside in some ways makes no sense, but on the inside makes a lot of sense. My job is to figure that out the best I can, not at like a grandmaster level, but as sort of a, you know, a late in layman's terms, and to take out of that to a bigger audience the stuff that I come to believe is important about it. Some of it is little details, but more of it is sort of the bigger picture. What are the things that connect this little subculture with the broader world? What are things that we can learn from this little thing that are applicable to our everyday lives?
You open chapter 3, which is titled Riding Betty White. And you wrote, they call it a cluster. It's not officially short for quote unquote clusterfuck, but the fuck is sometimes implied. A cluster is a typical weekend on the dog show circuit. If Westminster is the Super Bowl, clusters are the regular season. It's where dogs earn the points and need to qualify for Westminster. A dog can't get to the big show unless it shines in the little ones, in the anonymous civic centers and livestock arenas with almost nobody watching. That's where the top dogs emerge and pretenders wilt and the handlers crash after 18-hour days. It is a whirlwind of fur and chaos, which is perfect because you do exactly what you're talking about. And I wonder, like, all right, you accumulate all this knowledge, and then you have to go back and sort of break it down into these micro terms that idiots like me, people who pay no attention to dog shows at all, need to understand. Is it a trick to figure out how to make it basic and explanatory without being stupid and demeaning.
I don't think it's a trick. I mean, I think it's a skill. It's something that I've learned and developed over many, many years of doing this and doing this type of story over and over and over, which is, you know, I think of this the same way. Like, for example, I did a story on Dale Earnhardt Jr. for ESPN. I knew what NASCAR was. I had the basic idea. I didn't know the ins and outs of it at all. He was sort of my Sherpa through that world, guiding me, and it helped explain to me what it means. You know, I go in, I figure this stuff out, and then I think about who's going to be reading this book. You know, the people who are going to be reading this book, by and large, are people who don't know what dog shows are. I mean, I have a little two-page thing in the very beginning of the book about, here's the very basics about how a dog show works. So I'm going to explain it to you from like 0 to 60, but along the way, I want it to be funny and interesting and relatable. And so I'm going to try to explain it in a way that has analogs or metaphors or whatever it is to other parts of life, so that you don't have to like know the dog show glossary to know what's going on.
Do you have any inclination inside of you? I know you're not a mean person, so I'm not saying it this way, but when you see stuff that seems utterly ridiculous, like I feel like when you're a young writer in particular, maybe you weren't this way, I certainly was. The first instinct is to mock and make fun. Oh, this is so stupid. This is the dumbest thing ever, blah, 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 blah. And I wonder when you're in an environment like this where there's so much craziness and stuff that seems kind of ludicrous from afar, if there's any inclination you need to suppress, step back, say, wait a second, is this how I want to approach this thing that seems really weird, but maybe isn't?
Well, it's certainly weird. There's no doubt about it. But I think kind of a revelation for me, and I don't know that there was any like peal of lightning that caused me to think this, probably just doing this kind of stuff over and over. Everybody's got something, right? Like, I love pro wrestling. I've loved it my whole life. I know the language of it. I know the rules and regulations, how it works. So the mores and mores of it, all that sort of thing. People who don't love it just are, you know, relentlessly mocking of it. And I understand that mocking. In this book, it's the dog show business. And even though it is strange, even though it is extremely quirky, even though to the outside it seems ludicrous in a lot of ways. In fact, one of the reasons that I chose the dog handler that I did to sort of take you through the narrative of the book is that she was really into it, but she was also able to step back and be detached and sort of see the absurdity of it. Like, she knows some of the stuff they do is weird as hell, but she loves it anyway. And don't you want that to be the way you approach something you love, right? Like, even though you know it's weird and crazy, whether you like making flower arrangements or deep sea fishing or whatever it is, you have something that you love that's crazy to the outside world, but you love it anyway.
All right, what is the top of your head? What is the weirdest, absolute weirdest thing you saw while reporting this book?
Oh, man. I think the grooming is a thing that struck me as something that I just did not fully understand when I walked in. So these dogs are groomed when they're at a big show for like 5 or 6 hours a day. It's like, it reminded me of when there's like a big budget, like Hollywood movie with lots of special effects, and you see these videos of the actor sitting in the makeup chair and getting like 6 hours of makeup. It's like that. You know, there are like all these like specific combs for different parts of the coat. There's all these like different hairsprays and powders and ribbons and combs and, you know, trimmers and all this like incredible accoutrements, you know, that go with grooming these damn dogs, some of which have to be like, these poodles have to be finely sculpted, you know, to give that sort of balloon animal poodle look. But even a dog like the dog that's sort of the the star of my book, a Samoyed named Striker, which is just basically a white, furry, husky-like dog. They still had to comb that dog like 3 or 4 hours a day. And it just that, you know, you walk through a dog show where the grooming area is, and it's just like there's like 2 inches of fur on the floor, and there's all these people doing this furious combing and fluffing, and it's just insane to me. Then you get into like the little edges, like sometimes people will put powder in a dog's hair to make the coat shine. There are, I found at one show, a couple of hair extensions on the floor, which I think are probably technically illegal for some dogs, but people do it anyway. It's just that whole idea of making that coat look perfect leads people to like insane levels of detail.
So when I wrote a book about the Shaq Kobe Lakers, I always liked Shaq more than Kobe because I always felt like Shaq was in on the joke. Like, I think Shaq thought it was funny and he understood we're making millions of dollars to wear pajamas and throw a ball through a hoop, and Kobe never got it. Do you feel like most of the people with the dog show are Shaq or Kobe?
I would say they lean more toward Kobe. Yeah. There's certainly, you know, the Larking, the woman I talked to for the book is more of a Shaq. Like, she understands that it's some of the, what she does is ludicrous, but she loves it anyway. A lot of the people I talked to, and this was a long sort of sorting process for me once I got into that world, I wanted to find somebody, a dog and a handler, to sort of be the narrative thread of the book. And Laura was probably the 10th or 12th person that I sat down and had pretty extensive interviews with before I found somebody who I thought would be good. A lot of the people there are just sort of wary of outsiders at all. You know, they just don't want people. They love the insularity of that world. Other people kind of felt like they got burned by Best in Show, the movie, or the couple of times I detail in the book when Conan O'Brien sent Triumph, the insult dog, who was just incredibly rude in his Triumph way at Westminster, going around like humping the other show dogs and stuff. I think people felt burnt by a couple of those things. And every year, somebody goes to Westminster and writes a sort of kind of mocking piece about it. And so I think for good reason, people there are sort of like gun shy of somebody coming in to interview that. And I certainly wanted some of that absurdity in my book, and it's in there. But I had a like a bigger view, a kind of a longer game that I was trying to play for my book. And it took me to get to Laura before I finally found somebody who I thought understood what I was trying to do.
Did she understand that she was going to be playing this role in your book?
Yes. So we talked, you know, for a while at the, you know, at the beginning and the middle. I said, look, I'm looking for somebody who can sort of be the reader's guide and my guide through this process. And I, you know, the other sort of sorting part of it is I had to pick a dog that's a really good dog, because I wanted them to be contend for the championship at Westminster. I didn't know how far they were going to get, but I wanted a dog that had a shot. And so she had one of those dogs that had a shot. And so when I was talking to her about it, I said, look, people who are going to read this book who don't know anything about dog shows, I want to be able to tell them what it's like from the inside. But I also want somebody who could see it from the outside too. And as I talked to her, I just thought she was so open, so interesting, and so like amused at the whole experience of being a dog show person that she ended up being perfect.
When you attach yourself to someone, when you're working on a book and then you're writing the book, do you at all think about, worry about how will they receive the book when they see it?
Absolutely. I mean, I try not to let that change what I do. Because as I tell everybody up front, you know, I'm going to write what I see. Like, there was some point in the book when Laura started to say something, I said, well, hang on a second. Are you quoting me on this? I said, Laura, if you're talking to me, just assume it could go in the book. And she said, okay. You know, and then we went on from there. I sent her a copy of the book. She really liked it. She wrote me a very nice note about it. If she had not liked it, certainly it would have upset me. I wouldn't have like gone back and tried to change anything or anything like that. But somebody who spends that kind of time with you, you know, you certainly want them to, at the very least, feel like you got it right, even if it may not be flattering to them. Like when I've, you know, you've written tons of profiles, I've written tons of profiles. My goal in writing a profile was always, does that person feel like it's fair? Whether it's something they like or not, I don't really care. But if they feel like I went in, gave them a fair shot, and here's what I came up with, that's all I can sort of hope for.
I have this ongoing debate, not debate, discussion. There's a writer, I don't know if you know him, Jonathan Eich. He wrote this MLK biography recently.
Yeah. Huh?
Really good guy. And every now and then I'll be like, ugh, this book is killing me. I don't know how I do this. I'm losing my mind. I hate this. You know, after we do this podcast, I'll probably go to some coffee shop with 7 bags of Tupac material and just he's more of the mind. Are you kidding me? Like, I'm getting paid to get a PhD in Martin Luther King. You're getting paid to get a PhD in Tupac. You're getting paid to get a PhD in dog shows. This is the best job in the world. And I wonder, when you're working on a book like this and you have this long of a time to do it, and there's so much material and so much you don't know, can you walk through life with a pep in your step and this is the best thing ever? Or do you walk through life with a somebody stab me in the back of the head, please?
Well, the truth is it's both, right? Like, my wife tells me that every time I work on a big project, whether it's a book or even like a long magazine story, at every phase of that project, I have like a dark night of the soul, right? When I'm reporting the book, there's always a point when I'm like, oh my God, there's so, like, on this book in particular, just think about trying to like corral all the world's information about dogs, right? It's impossible. And so I'd have these times where like, man, I'm never going to understand this world well enough, right? So then I do the reporting, I start writing, and I'm writing, and I'm like, I'm never going to do justice to this story. I'm never going to like get a firm grip on it all. And so I have these like terrible dark nights. And then when I turn the book in and we're in the spot we are now, like before publication, I'm like, nobody's ever going to buy this damn book. You know, no. And so it happens every time. And I can't stop it. I probably don't want to stop it because it's a sign that I'm like, it's like, you know, if you run a marathon, at some point you're going to get cramps, right? So I do feel all those things. At the same time, you know, my dad did blue collar jobs his whole life. Like, he was a carpenter. He was an electrician. He worked at a seafood packing plant. When he was a young man, he was a logger pulling damn pine trees out of the South Georgia woods. My career, in every estimation, monetarily, workload, by any measure, is a million times better than the best work day of his life. And it's also better than the best work days of most of the people I know. So I cannot legitimately complain much. You know, it's that old line from what's that Joe Walsh song, Life's Been Good? He said, I can't complain, but sometimes I still do, right? Well, I still do. But if I take a step back and I'm honest about it, I've had an amazing career of opportunities to do these great stories. It has been greater than I ever imagined it would be. And I just feel incredibly, I feel incredibly lucky that those dark nights of the soul are like the worst that it gets.
I'm going to go some stages with you. Tell me if you hit these stages, okay?
Oh, sure.
Number one, do you hit the stage? I'm never going to be able to hand this book in. This is terrible. It's never going to happen. This is it. This is the book that fails for me.
Oh, like 10 times for each. Yeah. And like at the end of every damn chapter, you know? Yeah, absolutely.
What about, I'm a horrible writer. I can no longer write. I don't know. Maybe I was good at some point. I don't have it anymore.
I'll tell you what I do. The short answer is yes. The longer answer is I feel almost ashamed to say this. I go back and read some of my best old stories, and it's like, well, that dude can write. You know, you can be that guy again. You know, you didn't just like lose the ability to do this. You can do this. So I had to basically like go like look at my old game tape, you know, to show that, yeah, I can probably do this again if I need to.
That's amazing. I do that too. I'm glad to hear someone else does that. And then my worst, this is my worst. I hand it in. I tell myself it sucks. I tell everyone in my little universe it sucks. And then some editor tells me they really like it. And that flips it for me. All of a sudden, I'm like, oh, must be good. Like one person telling me it's good changes my entire outlook.
So this is something that editors, I think good editors know, bad editors let go. There's that gap between when a writer turns something in and they get the first feedback from the editor.
It's horrible.
And that gap, the writer fills with like the blackest thoughts you can imagine, right? Like, not only is this book not any good, they're going to make me give their advance back. You know, they're going to take the money that they already gave me. They're going to take me to court because this book is so terrible that it just doesn't meet any standards of publishable material, right? They're going to tell the world about this. I'll never be able to write again. Your imagination fills that gap with like the worst possible stuff. And then, as you said, they call you back. And then, you know, in my case, my editor said, oh, this is really good. I've got some thoughts, but this is really good. And it's like, oh yeah. Okay. I'm not going to die. You know, it's kind of feels like that. Like when you have a migraine or something that won't go away, there's some part of you that says, God, this might actually kill me. Right. And then you take an Excedrin or whatever, and it goes away. And like, well, that was stupid. Why did I think that? It's the same thing with these things. You know, obviously, there's sometimes you do turn in something that needs a lot of work, and that happens to everybody. But I've never turned anything in that even remotely, you know, comes close to like the worst of my imagination about it.
How do you handle, I don't know, you get the manuscript back and the editor's like, you know, I really think blah, 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 where you see the lines cross through a couple of things. How do you handle edits personally?
You know, in my experience, and everybody's different at this, in my experience, most of the things that the editor gives me feedback about are stuff that I knew needed fixing when I turned it in. It's stuff that I didn't quite get there. Or, you know, I was trying to meet deadline. And so I sort of like did the best I could, sent it in. All, you know, occasionally I'll get something that's a real surprise to me or something that I, you know, disagree with pretty strongly or whatever, but that's pretty rare. Oftentimes what I get is they're telling me what I already know and they may have a better perspective on it than I do, but it's like, yeah, I got to work on that. And so that's often been my experience.
I don't know if you went through this as a younger writer versus as a more seasoned writer, but when I was a young writer, I remember at the Tennessean, they'd be like, yeah, we're going to change. You have a sentence and it says he ate American cheese. We're going to change it to he enjoyed his American cheese. And I would be like, no, you're ruining the whole thing. You are ruining everything. You can't. And now I'm like, yeah, that sounds good. 90% of the time I'm like, all right, that sounds good.
Yeah, you do have to choose your battles. And I was one of those people early on who was not good at that. I would, you know, argue some verb tense, you know, down to the death. But the longer I've done this, the more I try to see the big picture, which is that whether that word is enjoyed or ate makes a 0.0001 difference in anybody's understanding or enjoyment of the book. And if it makes the editor happy to do it and it doesn't like, I feel like wreck anything major, I'm usually going to let it go. And I've found that my experience of being edited greatly improves with that. And I have not had a single time when any reader pointed out one of those things to me as like something in the book they thought was off.
Well, that's a funny thing you learn over time is like all these horrible edits that you think ruin the piece. They never get noticed by the reader ever.
No, because the readers, I mean, if you think about how people read books these days, many people are reading a book with like the TV on, or they're listening to an audiobook when they're driving, or they're looking at their phone and they're flipping over to Twitter every 5 minutes or whatever. I mean, I care about language. I care about what I write. I want it to be as good as possible. But I also, the main thing I want is for people to take away the big things from my book. It's sort of like that. They talk about somebody who has dementia, and they say they might not remember what you tell them, but they'll remember how you make them feel. That's what I want people to take away from the book. I don't want them to, if there's a really pretty sentence in the book that they like, absolutely fantastic. I love that. But what I want them to take away from the book is kind of what I wanted them to feel, the emotions, the meaningfulness of it. And that is, you know, more of an accumulation of all those sentences than it is any one sentence.
Yeah, very well said. I am kind of fascinated. You know, the reporting process, especially with books, drives me crazy because it's this accumulation of information over time that becomes this big pile. You're working on this book for a long time. When you're interviewing people, when you're with the different people at the shows, are you recording and then transcribing? Or are you just taking notes? How do you organize all this stuff? I know it's a nerdy question, but I'm actually interested.
No, that's fine. I record it all. And then I may be the last person in America who actually pays to have it transcribed. I have it transcribed by like humans. And, you know, I think for this book, all the transcriptions probably cost me $2,000, but one, that's a tax write-off. Mm-hmm. And two, I know when it comes back, it's going to be clean. And in a way that if it's done by AI or, you know, some program or whatever, I often find that it takes me about as long to clean it up as I would have to just transcribe it in the first place. And so I record all that stuff, have it transcribed, dump it all into, you know, Google files, and then refer to them, you know, constantly as I'm writing to make sure I get quotes right. And then sometimes if the transcription is garbled or whatever, I do have to go back. I keep all the audio, and I sometimes have to go back and listen to the audio itself to make sure I know what somebody said.
And is it like a big whirlwind of shit for you, or do you feel organized as you're writing the book?
I've never been great at being organized. And in fact, one of the things I'm doing in this in-between period before I write another book, if I get to write another book, is trying to figure out how to get my shit together on organization, because I'm not good at it. This book, I had thousands of like web pages saved in Pocket, which I found to be very easy, but Pocket's terrible at finding stuff. Once you put it in there, it's really hard to search for stuff. So I had a bunch of other stuff in Evernote, and then I had a bunch of stuff in Google Docs and Google Drive and that sort of thing. And then there was just like books and paper, you know, like magazines I'd read. I have a whole shelf of books next to my desk here, dog-related books. And so at some level, you can't just keep all that in your head anymore. And I did have a few times during this writing process when it just took me a longer than it should to track down some fact, because I had not filed it away in an organized way.
I am the moron who still prints everything out.
Ah.
Yeah, terrible, terrible. And my wife keeps saying, you need to stop. And I'm like,
Well, I did for the last book. Probably should have printed out some stuff for this book too. It just makes it visually easier to find stuff for me.
Before we continue with Two Riders Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman. I'm here with my son, Emmett, who's really enjoying watching me write my Tupac Shakur biography.
Dad, what does I'm a fucking failure, fraud, piece of shit, douchebag, ho dickwad, and I'll never accomplish anything mean?
What?
I heard you say that yesterday while you were sobbing in a fetal position under your desk.
Yeah, that must have been someone else.
It was you in your office with your girlish whimper.
Ugh, what's your point?
My point is, you always do this when you have a book due, and there's only one solution. Let's go to royalretros.com and pick out some great throwback USFL gear. Maybe that sweet Chicago Blitz hat you've been eyeing, or a cool Sam Mills Baltimore Stars jersey.
Huh, will that help me finish my book?
No, but you'll stop crying like a little bitch.
You write a weekly Substack, The Writing Shed with Tommy Tomlinson. My friend Michael J. Lewis, not Moneyball Michael Lewis, turned me on to it years ago. I love it. I love everything about it. I think it's fantastic. I always learn something new. I just want to read real quick. You recently wrote about Kacey Musgraves' new album, and which I've only listened to now because of you. So I just want to know you had an impact. You wrote, I was having a tough day earlier this week, so I turned to one of my favorite natural remedies, listening to new music. I went for a drive and queued up Kacey Musgraves' new record, Deeper Well. It hit me like a sledgehammer. Okay, a sledgehammer wrapped in a lavender-scented comforter, but still. I don't follow the ins and outs of Musgraves' personal life, so I don't know how any of this tracks with reality. But to me, the album sounds like they're slowly working their way out of one relationship and slowly working their way into another. Her first few songs about letting go, the last few about holding on. It could be lovers she's singing about. I guess she could be singing about herself. Everything here is quiet, understated, mostly just acoustic guitar and voice. A lot of it sounds like the softer side of Fleetwood Mac, and that's not a dig. And you really go into her music and her songwriting. I feel like every week I'm learning something new. Like, why do you keep up with this? It seems like a lot of time.
There's a couple of reasons. I mean, one creative and one practical. The practical reason is I think every writer needs to have their own audience, right? Something that belongs to them. Because you usually write for other people. If you work for other companies, those companies, as we've seen in the media landscape, tend to fall apart and crumble. You need something that's yours, whether it's a website, Substack, a newsletter, or whatever. So I have this Substack. I have people who subscribe to it. I know through their email who all these people are. I can reach them in 30 seconds with an email if I need to. They follow me. They buy my books. Some of them pay to subscribe to the Substack. They're my fans. You know, they're sort of my core group. And I need to carry those people around with me wherever I go. Mm-hmm. And that's just sort of a practical reason for doing that, is that I want people who like my stuff to be able to have a place to get it regularly. The creative part of it for me is there's a lot of stuff that I'm interested in and like to write about that don't really fit anywhere else. You know, I don't really, by and large, I'm not really a magazine writer anymore. I don't try to sell pieces to magazines. I don't, you know, pitch big profiles and stuff like that. But there's always been this little stuff, like writing about a new album I like, or just writing about, you know, the flowers in spring or something deeper and darker, whatever it is, that I would probably write in my journal at night if I didn't put it, you know, somewhere else. But it's in a creative way, it's just an outlet for me to write about these things that I'm interested in. And, you know, the things that are just super personal just to me, I usually don't put in there. But stuff that I think other people might be interested in or care about, I write about those things. And so it's just, you know, it's like, it's basically the new version of a blog, you know, it's, or, you know, a newspaper column or whatever it is. It's just a way to get, you know, I don't like to be pigeonholed. I like to write about a lot of different things, and this is a way for me to do that.
I also find it keeps me sharp just on a base level.
Absolutely. It's getting reps.
All right. Let me ask you a final question. Now I had you on the show once before years ago, and I asked you the question I usually end with, which is, what's the best confrontation of your career? So I'm going to throw a better one at you, which is this. It's, I don't know, tomorrow, and you get a call from Avid Reader Press, your publisher, and they say, Tommy, we have a book we really want you to do. We think it's a great topic. We think you're the perfect guy to do it. We want you to write about O.J. Simpson's final two NFL seasons with the 49ers. We'll pay you $2 million for the book. We want it just to be a football book. We want fans to have a real good taste of O.J. Simpson at the end of his career with the Niners. $2 million. We're going to call it The Juice is Loose, My 2 Years in San Francisco. Do you do the book?
Oh, man. So the honest answer is no. I would not do that book for this reason. You know, somebody told me as I was just starting out in the book business, when I was pitching ideas, I think my agent told me this. He said, whatever you pitch as a book, just remember, you're going to have to live with that for the rest of your life. Because not only are you going to have to live with it during the time that you write the book, if it succeeds, or even maybe even if it doesn't, people are going to find that book forever. It's going to be on shelves. It's going to be in libraries. People are going to associate you with that topic or that book forever. Do you want that to be the case? And I would say, in this case, that's not worth $2 million to me. You know, if I was 25 and broke, I would do it instantly and not worry about the consequences. I'm in a spot in my life when I need the peace of mind more than I need the $2 million. Not that I have anywhere close to $2 million, but I don't know what I would do with that money that would make me feel good enough about myself to have written that book.
Number one, Avid Reader Press, give me a call. I'm in. Number two, I just want to say, Tommy, from one sports guy to another, 1978 San Francisco 49ers, okay? They had two quarterbacks take their reps. One, Steve DeBerg, threw 8 touchdown passes and 22 interceptions. Their backup, Scott Bull, started 5 games and threw 1 touchdown and 11 interceptions.
Jeff, I have to ask you a question. Did you know this?
No.
Did you just look it up, or did you look it up in the framework of, maybe I should write about OJ?
You must be like this. Do you go down the rabbit hole of sports obscurity and you find
absolutely, yes. But that particular rabbit hole, I'm staying away from.
Yeah, fair enough. We will not be expecting the Tommy Tomlinson.
Now, if it's $10 million, okay, we'll talk.
Well, listen, number one, Dogland is awesome. It's such a fun book and such a joy.
Thank you, Joe.
The ability to be educational and hilarious at the same time is a real sort of treasure trait that you have, the ability to do that. So, and I appreciate you doing this. You've joined the Two Timers Club 2 times on Two Writers Slinging Ink. So thank you so much.
I look forward to getting the robe in the mail. So
don't hold your breath.
All right, man.
I want to thank today's guest, Tommy Tomlinson, for joining me on Two Writers Slinging Ink. You can follow Tommy on Twitter at Tommy Tomlinson and buy Dogland, Passion, Glory, and Lots of Slobber at the Westminster Dog Show, wherever books are sold. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Slinging Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really appreciative. Music is by the fantastic MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me, and remember, keep riding.